Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we will continue now with the study of the Samadhitti Sutta. This is the Discourse on Right View, Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 9. Okay, last week we covered the section on the four nutriments. And this week we come to the section on the four noble truths. Okay, so after Venerable Sariputta had given his explanation on the four nutriments, then the monks expressed their appreciation, and then asked him if he could explain right view from still a different angle. Okay, and Sariputta proceeded and said, and here I am on page 134, paragraph 14. First he gives the Uddesa, that's the short, condensed teaching. When, friends, a noble disciple understands suffering, that's dukkha, the origin of suffering, dukkha samudaya, the cessation of suffering, dukkha nirodha, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, dukkha nirodha gamani patipada, in that way, he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, this is a brief statement of the Four Noble Truths. And then Sariputta will go on to elaborate on the Four Noble Truths. But first, we should just make some general remarks on the Four Noble Truths, that these are the teachings, or this is the teaching which is generally held to be, we call it the essence or core of the Buddha's teaching. When the Buddha gave his first discourse, according to the traditional records, the first discourse to the five ascetics, the five monks in the Deer Park at Benares, what he taught was the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. And then if we read the discourses, we see time and again that when the Buddha gives a discourse, when he builds it up gradually to its climax, when he reaches the climax, what he teaches is the Four Noble Truths. Often when we get basic books on Buddhism, they'll begin right off by saying, what is Buddhism, the essential teaching of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths. But actually when the Buddha gave teachings, he didn't start off with the Four Noble Truths, but he would usually start off in a sense of cultivating the mind of the person who is listening. Because the Four Noble Truths, when you really reflect on them, they're very difficult teaching to accept, to understand, and to accept. And so the Buddha would start off by cultivating the minds of the people to be trained, by giving what is called the gradual or graduated discourse on the Dhamma. He would begin with talk on dana, on generosity, giving, talk about sila, the benefits of virtue, morality. Talk about, it's called Saggakatha, talk about the heavens, the law of karma and its fruit, how good actions lead to good results, how practicing generosity, observing precepts, developing qualities like kindness, helpfulness, compassion in everyday life will bring the accumulation of merits that will bring rebirth into heavenly realms. And it's only when the Buddha knows that the mind of the person listening has become calm, serene, trusting, confident, and free from hindrances, that is, that the mind of the person has become clear, almost in a state of samadhi. The hindrances have gone, though the person is still in an active consciousness because they can listen. But it's only then that the Buddha will teach the Four Noble Truths. And whenever the Buddha teaches the Four Noble Truths, then, because he's prepared the mind of the person, then that teaching will go so deep into the mind of the person that the person will usually gain the eye of Dhamma, the eye of insight into the truth of the Dhamma. But nowadays, if we start off, people like me giving talk on generosity, morality, karma, heavens, people don't believe in that. People want to know what is really special and distinctive about Buddhism. And so we have to start off by saying the fundamentals of Buddhism are the Four Noble Truths, but actually that's not really the case. And then there are other suttas where the Buddha says that, for example, that the reason why we have roamed and wandered through samsara, the round of rebirths, for such a long time is because we have not seen, understood, and penetrated four things. What are these four things? The noble truth of suffering, noble truth of the origin of suffering, noble truth of the cessation of suffering, and noble truth of the path. And then the Buddha says, now for me, these noble truths have been seen, understood, and penetrated. And then if you look in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Saccha Samyutta, the collected sayings or discourses on the truths, the Buddha speaks so often about the Four Noble Truths, and then he says to the monks, he says, therefore, yogo karaniyo, idang dukkanti yogo karaniyo, which means the work should be done. This is suffering. The work should be done. This is the origin of suffering. The work should be done. This is the cessation of suffering. The work should be done. This is the path to the cessation of suffering. And what is meant by this expression, the work should be done, that means that one has to make an effort to understand these truths, to understand them at different levels, intellectually, first intellectually, then at deeper levels intellectually, then experientially through the practice of meditation on the Four Noble Truths, and then at the deepest level of experience through penetrating wisdom. You say at the level of realization. So we have intellectual understanding, experiential understanding, and experiential realization. Okay, and one who has gained the clear, penetrative understanding of all Four Noble Truths becomes a sotapanna, a stream enterer. So that is the mark of the stream enterer, is the penetrative understanding of all Four Noble Truths. Okay, and now the four truths, if we consider them, we look at them together, we would see that they actually form two pairs. They form two pairs. And each of these two pairs consists of two items in a, we call it a cause and effect relationship. So we start off with dukkha, the truth of suffering. Then we take the cause or origin, the origin or the cause of suffering. Then we take, so the second noble truth is dealing with the cause of the first noble truth. Then the third noble truth is the cessation of dukkha, the cessation of suffering. This actually, as we'll see, it actually turns out to be nirvana, nibbana. Nibbana is not really an effect of anything. It's not brought into being, but it is reached or attained by means of a cause. And that cause is the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path or way to the cessation of suffering. So these two pairs, we can call them maybe the mundane pair or the samsaric pair and the supramundane or nirvanic pair. Now, usually when we think of causation, we think of the cause coming first or being more fundamental, and then the effect following from the cause. But here we see that the Buddha, when he formulates the Four Noble Truths, begins with the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering. And why does he do this? Why not begin just logically with the cause? I think the reason he does this is because, in a way, like, this is how he delivers his message. The real aim of the teaching is to lead beings to freedom from suffering. So in order to lead beings or people to freedom from suffering, first he has to awaken them to their condition. Like, normally we live in this condition of, we call it like the burning building, the blazing building of the house of samsara, burning with the fires of birth, old age, sickness, and death. But we think it's a very delightful place, a pleasure palace, with many hidden pleasures in one room after another room and another room. And we don't see that the whole house is on fire. And so when the Buddha appears on the scene, he's not going to explain to us how fire originates, how the house caught fire. He won't come into the house and tell us, this is how the house caught fire. Isn't this interesting? But rather, he comes and says, the house is on fire. Make an effort to get out. This is the exit. And so he has to, in a sense, alert us, awaken us to the different aspects of dukkha that envelop our lives. And we see as we investigate the First Noble Truth that these aspects of dukkha operate at different levels, from coarse levels, which are, when we attend to them, are fairly obvious, to very hidden and subtle levels, which only somebody fully enlightened like a Buddha can discover and teach. Okay, and then when we come to the Nibbana pair, the Buddha first has to give us encouragement by saying that, yes, a way out from dukkha does exist. It is really there. It's possible to attain liberation. Then when he arouses that hope, that promise, that prospect of liberation, then he will show the way to liberation, the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, now we can come to the sutta, back to the sutta. Okay, now Sariputta is going to analyze these four terms in the Four Noble Truths. So in paragraph 15, he begins raising the questions, what is suffering? What is the origin of suffering? What is the cessation of suffering? What is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? Okay, now to explain the first noble truth, Sariputta says, here, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Not to obtain what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates affected by clinging, or now I would say the five aggregates subject to clinging, are suffering. This is called suffering. Okay, so this is a kind of definition or explanation of the first noble truth. And this is the characteristic way in the early Buddhist texts to explain a term, not by giving an abstract definition, but by enumerating different forms it might take. And now first we have to say something about the word, which is used to signify the first noble truth. The Pali word is dukkha. And we translate this, I have it on the board already. We translate this as suffering. Most other translators also use suffering. One new rendering is stress. Some have used, earlier translators use sorrow. But what is meant by dukkha is not necessarily felt and experienced pain or suffering. The word dukkha, it comes originally from a quality of feeling. painful feeling. But the Buddha has taken this word from ordinary usage and gives it a very broad sense, a sense we can say as expressing a world vision. So here dukkha means not only things or experiences that are painful and fraught with misery and sorrow, but it covers everything which is felt to be, every aspect of experience which is felt to be unsatisfactory. Every aspect of experience which is in some way can be evaluated as inadequate, as unsatisfactory, as giving grounds for dissatisfaction. And often this truth of dukkha is seen to derive from the fact of impermanence, so that everything that is impermanent is, for that very reason, unsatisfactory, and therefore dukkha. I'll come to that aspect of this First Noble Truth in a little while. Okay, but first, in the enumeration we have here in the text, here Sariputta, he's really repeating words of the Buddha. This isn't something original with him, but this is a stock or standard definition of the First Noble Truth. So he takes certain aspects of experience first that are obviously suffering. Birth is suffering. The two key points in life. One is coming into existence, birth. Does anybody remember their birth? Anybody who remembers it, raise their hands. Anybody remember the birth of a brother or sister? A child, yeah. Having a child, when the child comes in.
When my son was born, I was like, wow, suffering.
He wants to go.
It wasn't a popular sentiment in the hospital, I can tell you.
Was your son unique in crying it? Or?
No, but apparently it's not the kind of thing you say to the mother of the child.
Oh. Were all the other children that were being born, were they all smiling and laughing? Only your son was crying?
He was the only one. It was amazing.
What is that?
He was the only one who was crying.
The others were all?
No, I'm kidding.
For a moment, I thought you blew my lecture for tonight. I was ready to walk out of the room, you Millie. I think the Buddha was wrong. One hospital where all of the other kids come out smiling and laughing. What is that? A kid comes out to the world and says, "What time is it, Dad?" "Okay, it's 7:35 p.m. What's on channel 4 at 8 p.m? To see the Super Bowl. Okay. So, the baby comes out at the moment of birth, suffering, pain, it's pain. And then whether death is suffering or not, we don't know unless somebody here remember their death from a previous life. But everybody, or at least most people, look forward to death as suffering. I always remember this line from a Woody Allen movie. I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be around when it happens. Okay, so birth, suffering, then in between birth and death, there comes growing old, and the aging process really starts right after one is born, though one doesn't experience it as such until one gets to be, let's see, I'm 60 now, I'm not yet old, so when one is 75, safely removed. I'm sure if anybody 75 here, they must think one doesn't experience it till one is 80 or so. And then sickness is suffering. That, I will tell you, is very much true. And then, okay, so these are four key types of suffering that occur in life. Then the next terms we might call the vocabulary of suffering, different terms that are expressive of suffering. Sorrow, this is the response to disagreeable, unpleasant experiences. Lamentation, or in more common language, crying, weeping, when that sorrow becomes too much, irrepressible, and then we have to express it by weeping. Pain, which is bodily pain. Grief, or now I use the translation, dejection or sadness. This is any kind of mental gloominess, grimness, dejection, depression, unhappiness, dissatisfaction, and then despair or misery, when that suffering becomes so overwhelming that one gives up all hope. Often in the explanations of the First Noble Truth, we have two terms which are missing from this sutta because they're replaced by these five terms, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. What are those two terms? Does anybody recognize them as missing?
Be separated from what you want and to be, I can't do it here, but to be near what you, be separated from what you want and to be near what you don't want.
Yeah. What, more exactly, to be separated from what is pleasant and agreeable, and to be united what is disagreeable, unpleasant. And then the next one, not to obtain what one wants is suffering. This, I think, is quite obvious. Whenever one wants anything, whether strongly or even mild, if one wants something very strongly and one doesn't obtain it, then there is suffering. And if one wants something even a little bit, but one doesn't obtain it, then maybe one doesn't experience suffering, but there is some kind of feeling of grimness, grayness, moodiness, that things are not going one's way. And if one doesn't deal with that aspect of dissatisfaction successfully, then one will pass on that feeling of grimness, moodiness to one's neighbors, family members, friends, and they suffer as a result. And so one makes life miserable for others as well. Okay, these are all types of suffering or dukkha that we are acquainted with in our ordinary experience and that we can relate to and understand. But now we come to an aspect of dukkha that is very difficult to understand. And this is, I would call this, the real meaning of the noble truth of dukkha. What I would say is that the other types or aspects of dukkha that the Buddha includes in the First Noble Truth, these are almost, we call them, expedient means that he's using to bring the attention of the disciple to the deeper meaning of the deeper and truer meaning of the First Noble Truth. He's taking obvious or evident forms of dukkha and saying, well, if you look at these aspects of dukkha, you'll see that life isn't a bed of roses. It isn't all glory and wonders. But even though one might be ready to admit these types of suffering that the Buddha points to, birth, aging, and so on, one still thinks, well, there are truly that there are these types of suffering in life, but we also have our joys, our happiness, our meaningful moments. We do have our beautiful rainbows, our nice symphonies with the rainbow in the foreground, the symphony violin playing softly in the background. So why is it all dukkha? I think to understand the First Noble Truth, the suttas sometimes explain three levels of dukkha. And this is a way in which the commentators have used to help us to understand the different layers of the First Noble Truth. Okay, the first dukkha-dukkata, which I call as dukkha due to experiential suffering. Okay, this is the obvious types of suffering that we've just already discussed. So we could say that these obvious types of suffering, you know, painful bodily feelings, mental feelings of sorrow, grief, dejection, unhappiness, not getting what one wants, and so on. All of those are indicators, pointers to the unsatisfactory nature of life, the unsatisfactory nature of existence. But then with the second type, we go a step deeper to what is called viparinama dukkata, That means dukkha or suffering due to change. And what this implies is that anything which is pleasant and agreeable and that we hold to as enjoyable, anything we delight in, okay, we evaluate this positively as being happiness, but that experience, that pleasant experience, is subject to change, inevitably subject to change. If we understand it, we know that it arises through conditions. Those conditions are bound up with other conditions, which are bound up with other conditions. And this whole network of conditions is unstable. One little ripple takes place somewhere in the net of conditions. That ripple spreads waves across the net of conditions. And that wave knocks out the causes of our happiness. And then when the causes of our happiness are gone, then the source of our happiness is gone. I have a nice house, very loving family. Good job, everything very comfortable. Everything is meeting all of my wishes, no problems. Then maybe suddenly my wife gets cancer. My son in school gets run over and dies. And then that dream of a beautiful life changes and misery. Or I lose my job, and then suddenly I find myself in debt. And so, everything that we hold to as the basis for our happiness is unstable and permanent. And even at the time, we could say that when it changes, the result is suffering. But if we look at our situation at a deeper level, we can see even when we're in the midst of our enjoyment, when our family members are happy, healthy, everything is going well, even under those conditions, there is still this hidden layer of dukkha. This is the viparinama dukkha, consisting in the fact that all of these, every aspect of the situation is unstable, always subject to change, and we never know when the change will take place. Just everything might be going according to our wishes, perfectly smoothly, and suddenly just one little fluke in the system and our life plunges into misery. And so the more we just blindly enjoy our success, our bliss, and lose sight of the changeable nature of all conditions, the more we are setting ourselves up for the first type of suffering when things change. But all along, it is this happiness, success, prosperity that is, because it's unpredictable, how long it will last, because it's unstable, because it's subject to change, that happiness, success, prosperity is itself the suffering due to change. I think the texts say that youth is dukkha due to change because it turns into old age. Health has dukkha due to change because it's subject to sickness. And life has the dukkha due to change because it's subject to death. Okay, but the deepest layer of dukkha is called sankhara dukkata, which means the suffering due to formations or the suffering consisting in formations. And this we could say is the suffering, the unsatisfactoriness intrinsic to the nature of conditioned existence itself. And what this means is that conditioned existence, our existence, what we call ourselves, our persons, are just compounds, or you call them functional unities, made up of five components. And what are those five components? Those are the panchupadana khanda, the five aggregates subject to clinging. And so these five aggregates, what are they? There's the aggregate of physical form, what we usually call the body. The aggregate of feeling, that is the way we experience things as being pleasant, painful, or neither pleasant nor painful. The aggregate of perceptions, the way we perceive things in terms of their qualities, perceiving, conceiving. The aggregate of volitional formations, these are all the different factors involved in will, desire, impulses. And then consciousness, which is the basic awareness of what is happening. The knowing, cognizing, awareness. And all of these five aggregates exist as momentary processes bound together in relationships of conditionality, mutual conditionality. And so we take ourselves, normally we take ourselves to be independent persons, somehow existing above and beyond the body and mind, or existing within the body and mind and exercising some kind of mastery or control over them. But according to the Buddha's teaching, this idea of a separate, controlling I, of an independent self, or of a controlling self, this is a delusion. A delusion which arises from the functioning of these five aggregates. And when one sees deeply into the nature of these five aggregates, one sees that they are all just processes constantly in a constant flux of becoming, constantly, uninterruptedly, arising, subsisting momentarily, and then breaking up, passing away, and giving rise to the next event in the same series. So what we call the body, according to the Buddha's teaching, is a compound of the four material elements. This is rupa form, made up of the four material elements, which are four properties of solidity, fluidity, liquid, the heat element, and the air element. It stands for mobility. And then there are different types of secondary matter that arise based on these. But these material phenomena are constantly changing, arising, and perishing. And then based on this material body, this form aggregate, there occur the mental aggregates. The feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, the volition aggregate. Excuse me? I said feeling, perception, the mental formations or volitions, and consciousness. All of these arise together, occur together, and perish together. And so the reason why these five aggregates are dukkha, suffering, is because they are in this constant process of becoming. They're all impermanent in the sense that they all arise, persist just momentarily, and then perish. And this process goes on continuously from life to life, driven by craving and ignorance. And so these five aggregates are not merely just objective events, but sometimes they're spoken of as contaminated aggregates, in the sense that they are the products of karma, craving, and ignorance. And not only are they the products of past karma, craving, and ignorance, but in the present, much of the time they serve as the basis for more craving, more ignorance, more karmic actions. Okay, maybe I will stop at this point and then ask if there's any questions. And then next time we'll go on with the other noble truths. First of all, unsatisfactoriness is a rather unwieldy term. And, you know, if one is giving a talk to people unacquainted with Buddhism, and one uses unsatisfactoriness as a translation for dukkha, it seems like one is using a word which I think it's not even listed in the dictionary. So people have some difficulty relating it to it as a translation for dukkha, whereas suffering, I find, is the word that connects with people's experience and attracts them. But now, I find unsatisfactoriness is useful for allaying the objections and suspicions of people who are ready to jump up and say, well then, Buddhism is pessimistic. It's seeing everything as misery. Then one has to explain, well, when it says that everything is dukkha, it doesn't really mean that everything is painful, that everything is suffering, that everything is suffering, that everything is miserable. But dukkha really means not felt and experienced suffering, but it means that things are unsatisfactory, that they cause dissatisfaction. I don't like it very much because, for one thing, in the late 1980s, there was, probably it even continues now, there's like a popular thing is the stress reduction clinics. And so it seems like one is almost sort of trying to popularize Buddhism to make it appeal to the people who have too much stress and are going to stress reduction clinics and saying, okay, we have something to offer that can compete with the stress reduction clinics. But then the person who successfully comes through the stress reduction clinic says, well, I'm getting good results from my stress reduction clinic. What do I need Buddhism for? I don't mean to ridicule that rendering, though. It does have certain points going for it, that it does indicate that there's another aspect to dukkha than simply felt suffering. And it could be taken, if one takes stress, not just in the sense of the feeling of tension that people feel in their day-to-day lives, but stress as meaning some kind of imbalance, or you could say a stressfulness that pervades many aspects of existence, then it's all right. But when people hear the word, they don't immediately think of that. They think of what they feel, you know, after a hard day's work at the office, which you could say is a reason, a way to appeal to people. But I think it appeals at maybe too limited, the word appeals at too limited and too specific a level, or in too specific a way. Whereas suffering links up with a kind of, I would call it a more universal vision. And it also ties in with, because many of the great philosophers and great religious thinkers through the ages have been concerned with the problem of suffering. Whereas only in the last 30 years or so that the word stress has been considered a problem. Tom?
It seems the second and third levels seem sort of similar in that they both deal with change. Is there any kind of distinction that you could elaborate on?
Okay. It's true that there's some similarity, but between the second and third levels, excuse me, there's a little bit of change or stress in my throat. Okay, now it's more satisfactory. Okay, there's some similarity between the second and third levels, but what the second level is pointing to is the fact that it's at a grosser level. It's pointing out that the things we take to be happiness, we're now dealing, let's say, at the macroscopic level of our life, that the things that we take to be happiness, okay, I have a nice house, good family, good job, I enjoy a lot of pleasures in life, I have money so I can buy a lot of commodities, that these things are dukkha, unsatisfactory, because they are subject to change, and I don't know when the change will take place. And even, not even taking all of these this luxurious way of life, but any kind of pleasure that I might be enjoying is unsatisfactory because it's subject to change, it's bound to come to an end. But all of this is still a consideration from, I call it the macroscopic level, something that would become immediately clear to us through reflection. Okay, but this third level of dukkha is something that becomes apparent or clear when we have, or to see it, we have to go to, I would call it a microscopic level. We sort of have to zoom in on our immediate experience, sort of magnify it 500 times, 1,000 times, see it going from the gross level to the cellular level, molecular level, till we get to this level of we were able to see the experience just in terms of these five aggregates. And we see that what we consider to be this person here is just this bodily form, which is made up of momentary events, always just constantly like a churning, like cinders in a furnace, always burning and blazing, arising and perishing. And then mental processes, mental events made up of feeling, perception, volition, consciousness, again, very quickly, very rapidly, arising and passing away, arising and passing away. Yeah, Suki? That's an interesting way of looking at it. I never thought of it quite from that point of view. But the way you suggest, now it seems we could even, though they're all dealing with dukkha, but we could align them with the three characteristics and take the first one more especially aligned with dukkha, the second one more aligned with impermanence, the third one more aligned with non-self. But also, the third one is also connected with impermanence at a deeper level than the second. The second is just, we consider things as having a relative stability, but then they change when their supporting conditions change. So I have, you know, my nice house, my job, my wife, my kids, they're considered to be stable and relatively stable. But then something within this set of conditions changes, and then my happiness changes to sorrow. So that is a fairly coarse way of considering this impermanence. But when we view the experience in terms of the five aggregates, which are just sankharas, they're condition formations, then we see that they are things which are impermanent in that they, from moment to moment, they arise and pass away. And the real cause for their passing away is not some external condition, but things with in themselves they have the seeds of their own dissolution. Yang kinchi samudaya dhammang sabang tang nirodha dhammang. Whatever has the nature of arising, all that has the nature of ceasing. Paul?
Yeah, I often hear the Four Noble Truths compared to dependent origination. It's like somehow they exist within each other or related. But it seems like only the first two Noble Truths are contained within dependent origination.
Well, you see, the other side of dependent origination is the cessation side. So we could align dependent origination with the second noble truth culminating in the first, and then the cessation side is the third noble truth. But we didn't get to the second and third noble truth yet. We'll take that next week.
The second level of dukkha due to change, and the third level, the second is very obvious change, and the third is the that is very subtle change that is happening moment to moment. Can you say this?
Yeah, I would say it that way.
There's a French Buddhist who has tried to say something simplifying about dukkha and the life of every comment on it. She says that all suffering rises out of resistance, and resistance ultimately rises out of humiliation.
Out of what?
Humiliation. You resist humiliation. And if I think that way, then it seems that dukkha is not an objective property of things, but just a sign of ignorance.
The way she expressed that, it seems to be understanding dukkha in the limit, if I understand her correctly, as you're expressing it. Okay, let me just get that. She says, all suffering arises out of resistance, and resistance arises from humiliation. Okay, humiliation from an ego that's protecting itself. That seems to be understanding dukkha just in the sense of, I would say, a psychological suffering. So I don't think that's really going towards what I would call the heart of the First Noble Truth. It's still taking it more or less at the level dukkha, at the level of not getting what one wants is dukkha. It's not yet reaching the level of the five aggregates of clinging or dukkha. And it's taking dukkha, it's dealing with one aspect of dukkha as experiential suffering. Is there a question? I thought I saw a hand here.
Is it fair to compare the notion of becoming with the Greek Iker Heraclitus?
With the what?
The Greek thinker Heraclitus, who was talked about flux that which nothing survives.
It seems similar, though I'm not so fresh on my pre-Socratic philosophers. Goes back 37 years. But it sounds somewhat similar. I don't know if some Buddhist influence could have come over, or he could have come. They were contemporary.
Doesn't seem to be any evidence for
us. He could have come across it, come upon this idea independently. Did I see a hand? Oh, I'm seeing hands. Okay.
I have an interesting one. What about, there seems to be a mode in a lot of, well, not maybe not that many, but there are some youths in particular these days who inflict pain on themselves until it feels good. I mean, that's helpful.
There are some people who inflict pain on themselves until it feels good. Of course, that can happen, but I mean, the human possibilities are unimaginable. But it's still dukkha, even though it's a case of physical pain giving rise to a mental, we have to say it gives rise to a mental pleasant feeling for some reason. Excuse me?
Temporary, so it's not.
Yeah, it's a temporary pleasant feeling. But
it would be temporary while they were inflicting the pain, and then they would have more dukkha when they weren't inflicting.
Yeah. When they stop inflicting pain on themselves, then they feel dukkha. It's like this joke when the masochist says, please hit me, the sadist says, no. Okay, we have to stop now. We share the merits with the devas, the bhutas or yakshas, the nagas, long, and with all other beings, wishing them to be well, happy, and to protect the Buddha's Dharma. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.